Welcome to the Hope Unyielding podcast. I'm your host, Hope Johnson, and I have the privilege of talking to some amazing people about the stories of God's faithfulness in their lives. Today, I'm talking with Taryn Hutchison, author of One Degree of Freedom, a riveting young adult novel set in communist Romania. Taryn Hutchison wanted to be a writer since she was a child growing up in a small town on Maryland's eastern shore, with its 75 people, 3 million chickens, and her two imaginary friends. She put that on hold to pursue other things she loved, living abroad and visiting a host of countries on every continent except Antarctica. When she returned to the States, she married her favorite person and moved near San Francisco, where she began to pursue that long-ago dream. She wrote her first book, We Wait You, a memoir from her years as a missionary in Eastern Europe. Now she's come full circle, minus the imaginary friends, to live in another sleepy town, this time in Western North Carolina. Taryn holds a master's degree in writing and tutors writing at a small university. She has had several short stories, essays, and articles published. She's an Amy Writing Award recipient and a member of Redbud Writers Guild. Currently, she's working on two sequels to One Degree of Freedom, along with a nonfiction book, a true story of a prisoner, unfairly condemned and recently released. I absolutely love Taryn's book, One Degree of Freedom, and I'm so excited to have her on the show to not only talk about the book, but her experiences in Romania that inspired the book. To me, a mark of an excellent novel is that you completely forget you're reading. One Degree of Freedom was definitely this type of novel. With nuanced, engaging characters, intricately described setting, and exciting plot, I was entranced from page one. Late 1980s communist Romania was a fascinating backdrop for the story of Adriana, a 15-year-old engineering student who finds a window to the world outside her oppressive regime through reading banned books, an activity which sends her headlong into an adventure filled with intrigue and family secrets. I would love to give one of you a free copy of One Degree of Freedom. If you'd like to be entered in the drawing, send me an email at hopeunyielding@gmail.com with One Degree of Freedom in the subject line by February 10th. Now, let's meet Taryn. Well, Taryn, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's really a privilege to have you.
Thank you, Hope. It's a privilege to be here, and I've enjoyed chatting with you the few minutes that we have already.
Yes. No, me too, because I just finished your novel a while back, and I loved it for so many reasons, but it's set in Romania and Eastern Europe, and I have a real connection to Eastern Europe with the mission work that I've done in Russia and Belarus, so reading it for me was kind of like a walk down memory lane in some ways. So I really connected with it, but I connected with it not only because of that. I feel like it has something for everyone. I know that any book lovers will love it. I'd say someone who likes Narnia. Narnia plays a role. And it's a young adult fiction, which adults love young adult fiction. And then I would say anyone from, what would you say, age 11 and up would do well with this book?
That's right. I know some 10-year-olds and I know some people who are 89.
89. That's perfect.
That's the range that I know.
Oh, that's great.
So
would you be able to tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when I was a kid, I always wanted to write. And I wrote my first novel when I was just 10 years old.
Really?
And it happened to be historical fiction. But I just never did anything about it because there were so many other things that I wanted to do. And just recently, when I moved back to the States, I decided it was time to really start getting serious about writing. And so 5 years ago, I was in a master's program for Masters of Art in Writing. And in one of my grad classes, I started to say glad classes. I was glad to be in that grad. We listened to a speech by Neil Gaiman on how stories last. And Gaiman said that good stories make life worth living. And he said, sometimes good stories even keep you alive. Mm-hmm. And he told a good story. It was about his cousin during the Holocaust. She was in the Warsaw Ghetto. And she would, every night she would read novels. They were all forbidden. And then the next day she would retell the stories to a group of girls. And the girls were spellbound. Mm-hmm. She risked her life and their lives to do that. And so years later, Gaiman asked her, why did she do that? And this was her answer. She said, because in that hour, we got away. Immediately, I'm sitting in class listening to this speech, and immediately, it was like I was transported back to Romania, where I had heard almost those exact same words so many times. From my Romanian friends who told me that one of the ways they survived life under communism was by escaping into the world of fiction. Hmm. And particularly, they loved it if they could get their hands on any banned fiction, which would be by Americans or British authors. But I remembered visiting friends, and they would open wardrobes, and stuffed in every corner, nook and cranny, there were just stacks and stacks and stacks of paperback books. And these were not so much banned books, but they were just books. I mean, they were voracious readers. And that's how they got away, was by reading and just getting lost in a good story. And so while I was in that class, I knew it was so sudden, I think it was a God thing, but I knew that I was to write a story about that somehow. Mm-hmm. And I had an hour-long commute where my class was. And by the time I drove home that night, the skeleton of the plot was already formed in my mind.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I just felt like, it was a real moment of inspiration. I knew I was supposed to write the story. And so then I started writing it a chapter a month for my class assignments. And it took a while to get it written. But the outline of the plot, just the broad strokes, I'm not an outliner. But the broad strokes came to me in that home from that class.
Wow. That's amazing. I know my brother loves Neil Gaiman, and he says he's very inspiring. I haven't heard much from Neil Gaiman, but now I'm interested.
Yeah. I love his book, Neverwhere. He's a fantasy writer, and he wrote a book called Art Matters. Case here that is just so wise. It's something that every artist and creative person needs to read. So,
well, that's really beautiful that the plot came to you at that point, and you knew that you're going to put together your experiences and knowledge of Romania into something special.
Yeah, into a fictional story. I mean, the story is completely made up, but it's just that it's based in historical reality and colored by my experiences.
So could you tell us a little bit about your experiences in Eastern Europe before we talk more about the book? What were you doing in Eastern Europe? Where did you spend most of your time? And I know you were there in a very difficult time in their history. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, right out of college, I joined the staff of CRU, at that time called Campus Crusade for Christ. And I was at different campuses in the U.S. for about 10 years. And I just, we would have times where we would pray all night long for Eastern Europe and Russia, because the need was so great. People were just being denied the gospel for 45 years for Eastern Europe, and much longer for the Soviet Union. So there was a great need, and And I knew that there would be a day that I would maybe not want to work with college students in the U.S., mm-hmm. do something else. And it just seemed unnatural to think about going overseas. And I always thought that I could use my art history background as a way to get in.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I decided to go when I went just because the need was great. And the doors were starting to open, and it just seemed like, why not? You know, this has been on my heart. How can you pray for something for years and not be part of the answer? And so I actually was in the pipeline to go before the revolutions happened.
Wow.
I kind of wish I had gotten there beforehand. But I went to Romania. And I was there for 5 years, and then I moved to Budapest, Hungary, and did an area-wide job shepherding the staff in the whole area, so all the countries of Eastern Europe. And in my last year, we added a few of the republics of former Soviet Union, too. I just didn't know them very well. So, yeah, so that's why I went, and I loved it. I loved it so much that I'm just not complete here in the States. It's like a part of my heart is always missing. But it's there, part of my heart was missing too. And just helps me to long for heaven when it'll all be together again. People I love will be
yeah. Wow, you're really speaking my language. I mean, that's what I didn't spend a whole 10 years overseas, but I spent probably 2 to 2.5 altogether. And I do oftentimes feel that when I'm here, I'm homesick for there. And then when I was there, I was homesick for my family, for the States. So that's beautiful how that points to heaven, our longing for heaven, when there won't be any loneliness or homesickness.
That's right.
Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit about your protagonist in your book? So the book's very character-driven, and I love character-driven fiction. That's what draws me to it. Your protagonist is wonderful, and I think people from ages 11 to 89 will connect with her on some level. So could you talk a little bit about her and her inspiration? Was she inspired by a real person?
She was, as a matter of fact. And during that drive home from that grad class, I knew what she looked like, and I knew her name was Adriana. And so I could picture her so clearly. She was petite, like a gymnast, kind of like Nadia Comaneci, which was typical. But what wasn't typical is that her hair was a little lighter brown than the typical Romanian would have, really dark brown hair and dark eyes. She had lighter brown hair and green eyes. And she just was somebody who just was curious. She just sparkled, and she feels things really deeply, and she's very much a stubborn individualist with her own ideas in a world where conformity was enforced. With only one way to think, look, talk, and act. And so I knew what she looked like, knew her name was Adriana, but honestly, it wasn't until I had the first draft written. Took a while because I did it so slowly while I had a full-time job and the grad school and everything. And after the draft was written, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that that's when I realized why I was so definite about Adriana. I knew her. I met an Adriana who was younger than the protagonist in my book. Maybe she was 12 or so. In 1990. And the reason I forgot about that is that my friends and I didn't call her Adriana. We had pet names for our favorite people. It was like an endearment thing. So we called her She Cry Now. The reason we called her that is the first time I met her, I walked into my church in Romania, and this little girl just ran up to me. We just connected immediately. Mm-hmm. Wanted to sit by me. And so we were like Velcroed together for the next few years. And she would always sit by me and ask to translate. And I said, sure, you know, I'd love for you to translate. But then as the service progressed, I found out that her translation skills were overrated. Somebody would stand up and talk for about 10 minutes, and all I would get from her was, he talk now. and then somebody else would get up, and she would say, he stand now. And wouldn't say what they said. And then there was a woman who stood up and cried. Mm-hmm. Adriana said, she cry now. So how come we named her that? And so I forgot that her name was really Adriana, but she was definitely the subconscious model for my character.
Oh, that's wonderful. She sounds really sweet.
She was so sweet. I just loved her.
Oh.
And I've lost touch with her. Man, I would just love it if somehow she found her way back to me and found this book and realized that it's her.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really sweet. I love that. She cry now.
Yeah, that's right.
So the next thing I wanted to ask about were aspects of Romanian culture and the politics at the time that made it into your book. So you did a really great job world building. And I felt like, although I hadn't been in Romania, I felt like I was there. I felt like I could picture things. First, could you give a little background on what was hard for you to adapt, what was different culturally, and then maybe what of that experience made it into the book?
Yeah. Well, yeah, everything was so different, but I went there kind of with a sense of adventure. And so some of the things that were different were just kind of exciting to adapt to. But I'll tell you, two in particular that were not at all, was having water 1 hour a day.
Oh,
that was really hard. It was an hour in the evening. And I think about what that would be like now with coronavirus.
Mm.
We would, when the water came out, we would try to save it in every pan or bucket or whatever we could. And that's what you use to wash your hands, but it wasn't very sanitary and it wasn't warm. So that was very hard to get used to. And then I would come back to the States. I would not turn the water on until that time in the evening. Mm-hmm. I would forget that, you know, that you can just turn it on at any time and it mm-hmm. worked. States. So it wow. took a while to get used to it in either direction. But the other hard thing was that at the time I lived there, there were 5 rats to every 1 person.
Ooh.
So I started out in a dorm on what floor was I on? I think I was on the 5th floor, which is 6th floor to Americans. And there were rats in our room. So they made it up that high and higher, I do know. But so that was hard. But most of the things that were different were just an adventure for the most part. I mean, mm-hmm. Everybody has days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Rats. Well, I did not have to deal with that when I was in Russia. I'm thankful for that. Yeah. That would have been. Did you set traps for them? How did you deal with
that? We didn't have anything like that, and there was nothing available in stores. So the guys on my team would rig up their own thing using Tupperware and, you know, plastic utensils and peanut butter, and they mm-hmm. caught the rats that way.
Okay. Oh.
And my roommate and I would just stand on our beds and scream.
Yeah, that would be me too. I don't know how long I would have lasted.
Yeah.
And the water, was it because there was a water shortage?
Maybe a shortage, but the government controlled everything. You just mm-hmm. didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
A arrived after the revolution, but it was less than a year after the revolution, and things didn't get worked out for several years there. So you never knew. You never knew what was true and what wasn't true. Mm-hmm. And the government just controlled it.
Okay. So even after the revolution, that
yeah.
was still...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. No heat. It was all controlled.
Okay. So. Now, your book is set... Is it set in 1986? Is that right?
87.
Or 87. Okay. 1987. Yeah. So that's just a bit before the revolution.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what life would be like for a student during that time in history under, and I'm going to try not to mangle his name, under Ceaușescu. Did I say that right?
Yes. That yes. was very, very good.
Okay, Ceaușescu. Good. Ceaușescu. Okay.
Ceaușescu.
Ceaușescu. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I didn't live there at that time. And of course, I'm American. But I had so many Romanian friends who described life to me then mm-hmm. that I think, and I ran my novel past a few Romanian friends. I mm-hmm. and hope I did a good job of capturing what it was like. But for students, one thing that would be surprising to Americans is how long they were in classes.
Hmm.
And I don't really have, I don't show the length of time in the book exactly mm-hmm. because I thought that might be unbelievable.
Hmm.
They were in class all day, and in college, they'd go straight from 8 to 8 without.
Wow.
But every test was comprehensive. So, it would be from like a test in seventh grade would include fifth and sixth grade too.
Okay.
And that you knew. And they didn't have their own textbooks. They had to share.
Okay.
And they would copy them down by hand. I have things like this in One Degree of Freedom, but since it's from Adriana's point of view, it's not unusual to her.
Right.
It's just life to her. So I had to get that information across very carefully. Another thing about the textbooks is when you would open them, mm-hmm. there would always be a picture of Nicolae Ceaușescu or his wife. Often his wife, Elena mm-hmm. Ceaușescu, they pretended that she wrote every science textbook in the whole country.
She was, wow.
She was touted to be a renowned chemist, but she really only went to elementary school.
Wow. And,
yeah, she was almost illiterate. So what else can I tell you about the schools? They taught by... negative reinforcement, not positive. And that happens to Adriana quite a bit in the book,
mm-hmm.
which ridicules her. And they had uniforms to wear, and they had one uniform and one outfit that they would wear at home when they were, you know, just goofing off,
mm-hmm.
a nice outfit. And that's all they had.
Mm-hmm.
So would get home from school and immediately remove their shoes and polish them inside the door, you know, before they even sat down. And then they would inspect their clothes for buttons that need to be sewn on or stains that needed to be spot washed or whatever. Mm. They took such care of their things. That's one of the things, Hope, that really impressed me when I moved there. And then when I would come home and watch Americans just be so frivolous
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In our reusable society where, you know, anyway, the professors were very stern,
mm-hmm.
inspired a lot of fear. And so anyway.
The negative reinforcement you're talking about is very similar to my experience in Russian culture. I observed at some schools, and I did see that. And it, you know, for the kids, it is very normal, I think, from an outsider's perspective. Yeah. I thought, why are you speaking to him that way?
Yeah.
So when I was reading it, I did recognize that part of the culture.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear a little bit about Christians during that time of the communist regime. What was their situation? What was persecution like?
Well, with everyone, there was just a lot of fear in the society. That was one of the ways that the government controlled the people, was by fear. And they were all told that one in every four or five people was an informer for the secret police, the Securitate. And so you couldn't trust anyone, not in your own family even. So there was a lot of fear and there was no trust. And with Christians, they had even more reasons to be fearful. Most churches were closed, but the ones that were left open had puppet priests and pastors who would spout the party line. And there would be informers in the services recording names of there. And after someone went to church, they would maybe lose their job, or they would be assigned a very menial job, like a janitor or whatever, and not be able to move up. Now, one thing about communist and socialist countries is that to move up with your job, you know, of course, doesn't mean a pay increase. The same, everyone lived in the same kind of flat. But what it could mean is just doing work that would be more fulfilling.
Right.
And be allowed that. And those were the easy things. The bad things were possible imprisonment, torture, death. That happened quite a bit. And you know, no one could actually talk about it. So I don't know statistics on that, but it did happen quite a lot. But here's the thing. The Christians who I knew were fearless, continued to meet in secret. And they didn't let that fear and that lack of trust stop them from worshiping God. And they would have blackout shades at the windows. If they met in someone's apartment, people would come every 20 minutes apart, but stagger their leaving too. And someone would have a Bible and they would tear the books out of the Bible and give the books to different underground churches. So you had the book of Isaiah. And then when you finished that, you passed it on to another group and you got 1 John. And so they had access to the Bible. It wasn't, not very many people I knew had an entire Bible. As a matter of fact, a lot of organizations in America tried to send Bibles to play Romania. It would be confiscated at the border and turned into, get this, toilet paper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Christians were fearless. And in the novel, I wanted to portray them. I wanted to portray, I have a real cross section of so much of the different types of people at that time and why they responded the way they did. And so I really hope that the Christians will really resonate with the readers of the book.
Yeah.
I loved creating them.
Yeah, no, I there's one scene in particular, I won't spoil it for everyone, that I'm thinking of that does sound a lot like what you were describing, and I really enjoyed that. Now, I also read your memoir, and you mentioned that when you got there, there was a huge hunger for the gospel as well. Could you talk a little bit about that and maybe any interactions you had that were really showed that hunger?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my memoir was called We Wait You, which is what everyone said when we got there. They said, "We wait you. What took you so long?" Basically. And they were looking for someone to come to bring political freedom for all those years that they were oppressed. But as missionaries, we came to talk about spiritual freedom. And whenever at the time that I was there, we couldn't do very much that was big and you know, out in the open at first. Then we showed the Jesus downtown. People would line up to come to a big event like the Jesus film. They lined up for blocks to get into that. And if we, when things became a little more open and we had different talks, just nobody famous on campus, it was the same thing. The rooms would just be packed. But in the beginning, of course, since things were not out in the open, it was just with every conversation that I would have with university students wanted to talk about Jesus. Many of them ended up giving their lives to Jesus, but they wanted to talk. They were just hungry. They knew that this name had been denied them for all years, and they wanted to know what it was about. They wanted to know everything they could, and you just don't find that here,
right? You
know? So it was really exciting. And we were always kind of afraid that maybe it was the novelty of it all and that people were responding to. And I'm sure it was with some, but a lot of the people who became Christians at the very beginning are still, you know, walking strong with the Lord. And many of them are leadership for Campus Crusade right now in Romania and even other parts of the world. So this is years since 1990. And so it wasn't a novelty for many of them. For most, I would say for most of them, it was not. They were hungry because they had been denied.
I think that's a good challenge for us in the U.S. If we, thinking about what you said, the Bible was so scarce and they treasured it and they treasured one book at a time. And we might not use the Bible for toilet paper, but there are oftentimes we let it sit on the shelf when we have access to it. So I do think when I do hear stories about people who've been denied the Bible and denied the gospel, it does really, it's a heart check for me. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I really like to do on the podcast is to tell stories of God's faithfulness. I know for me, that is always a huge encouragement for me when I'm going through something, when I hear someone else's story of how God was faithful to them. So I'd love to hear a few stories about your time in Romania. The first one that came to mind, first topic, was danger. And dangerous experiences that you had, how God showed himself faithful in those experiences. I know when I was abroad, I had a few experiences that were very scary, sometimes more looking back than in the moment. But, you know, as I look back on those times, I see God with me very clearly. So I'd love to hear any stories you might have.
Yeah. Well, I had a few dangerous things, but the one that really stands out to me was the last one. And that was And it had something to do with me leaving Eastern Europe. This was when I lived in Hungary. I lived in Hungary. And a guy with the Russian mafia had stalked me and into my flat and stole every piece of jewelry I had and my electronics. And but it was just so scary to have the Russian mafia there. You know, you just the Russian mafia. The police were there all night long, fingerprinting everything. I didn't realize what that was like. Then they leave, and there's just black goop all over everything in my flat.
Oh,
and the door couldn't close because the mafia had cut the doorknob out of it. So it was real scary. But, you know, eventually I stopped being so afraid. It took a while. It was kind of like some PTSD, I guess. I was upset that I had just brought my inheritance from my grandmother. To Hungary with me. And it was her diamond engagement ring from the 1920s. And that was taken. Just so disappointed. But I was convinced, I was just so convinced that God was going to find that for me. And I would search pawn shops and the little girls next door would search the yard, but it never showed up. And so that just continued to be a disappointment, but over time it lessened. And now, you know, it just doesn't matter all these years later. Time, I was scared and I was grieving, even though it's a thing difference. I knew that it wasn't a person, but it was a loss. So I think that the way I saw God's faithfulness is that when I would visit the nationals, as I traveled from country to country in our area, they just rallied around me. And I always felt love from them anyway. But I felt like after that, I had suffered, and they just expressed their love for me in a way that is just, it's just hard to describe how God that to comfort me. It was like he was loving me through them. And they helped me buy new pieces of jewelry from their countries. I mean, it wasn't expensive, very cheap pieces, but beautiful, you know, a pair of earrings or a bracelet or whatever. And those pieces that were purchased during my time of grief are almost more meaningful to me now than what I had lost. And so, yeah, God met me there, and kind of funny, but you know, I was single the whole time I was overseas. And after I got back to the States, I ended up getting married, and my fiance at the time, my husband bought me a ring that looked a lot like my grandmother's.
Oh, that's precious. Did he know? Was he trying to find one?
He did know. So that was another way to see God's faithfulness. But I think in the time it was just that, that he took care of my emotional needs.
That's wonderful. I mean, and that's kind of, that was one of the questions I had about being there without family, because when I was in Russia, I was only there for about a year by myself. All the other times I had been with a group, I'd been with other Americans. And this one time I was there for 9 months and I was the only American. I had no one.
And by the
end of the time there, I thought I couldn't do this. I kept thinking I couldn't live here long-term unless I was married or unless I was with a really close-knit group. So I was very impressed when I heard you had been there 10 years while you were single. And I was just wondering, you know, how did God help you in that? Yeah. Did you struggle with loneliness? And if so, do you have any other stories of how he met you through other people?
Yeah, I mean, sure, I did struggle with loneliness. Usually, I would say my life was full and and often I was with a close-knit team. In Romania, my teams were close-knit, and sometimes I had a single woman I lived with. Often I didn't, but the team kind of took up some of that. But in Hungary, those 5 years, I did not have a roommate. I was the only single woman on my team. And then I traveled a lot, and so I would come back just really tired. I would be on the trip and feel full with all the people, all the adventure and, you know, ministry, and just, it was wonderful. But then I would come home to a big letdown. And so at what I learned is to try my best not to wallow in that, to reach out to people when I felt lonely, for me to make the initiative to reach out to people. And it really helped me a lot if I could set something up before I would go on the trip, what day I was coming back. And I would set up a time with a friend for the day I got back. And that helped a lot. But sometimes you just, you know, couldn't arrange that. And the thing is that God was just so sweet to me, and that during my lowest points, there would always be a friend who would call and usually say something like, God put you on my heart. So it was just so sweet, because I knew that the Holy Spirit was taking care of me. But I can see that sweetness is so special to me, and that's why I choked up then. But one other thing I wanted to say is that I often thought too that I was lonelier because I was single, and for sure I didn't have the companionship of someone I was living with. But the married expat women soon convinced me that it was harder for them, that they were isolated, because they were stuck at home with little kids. And they couldn't get out to learn the language or to experience the culture. And so that was just such an isolating thing for them. And at least when I felt lonely, I could get out.
Right.
Go to someone's house, or, you know, I had more freedom there than they. And so anyway, but God definitely met me. It was just so sweet to me during those hardest times.
I love that, him putting you on others' hearts. And I know I've experienced that too. When I was abroad and I was alone, there were a number of those experiences. So it just, I think that's just a testimony to how intimately he knows us, and things like that just show that he really does care for us individually. And I'm sure that that also spilled over into your relationships with the Romanians, and they saw there's something different about you. I think that's a beautiful testimony. Thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Now, just to close up, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on, when someone picks up your book, what do you hope they'll come away with?
Okay. Yeah, a lot of things. My book is, I think it has a lot to offer different ages. And on the one hand, I hope that it will inspire young readers to read. That they'll want to read all of the books on Adriana's reading list, which is in front of the book. And I hope that they'll learn something about the Cold War era and about Eastern Europe and Romania in particular. And I hope that it will inspire people with hope, that no matter but that no matter how dark things get, that's kind of the theme I wanted to get across mm-hmm. in Degree of Freedom, is that there's always room for hope in the darkness. Mm-hmm. And I want them to be inspired by that. I want them to grow in their empathy to kind of step into someone else's skin who lives in a place that's very different and a time that's very different, and try to see the world through their eyes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I have a lot of hopes for it.
Yeah, well, I know you did all those things wonderfully, and I know it was right about the time I was probably 11 or 12 that I started to read historical fiction. So I think that really will resonate with a lot of people of that age group, especially because that you do a good job at showing, although she's in a very different place and era than kids today, she goes through the same things that they all do. Difficulties in friendship. That's a big theme. Difficulties in friendship, relationships with parents, and yet she is in a completely different reality than kids today are.
Yeah.
Well, I'm already recommending the book to quite a few people. It's one of my new favorites, and I know I'm going to be giving it as a gift. I'm going to be rereading it. So thank you for bringing this book into the world. And
thank you. It was a pleasure to bring it into the world. It took a long time. Mm-hmm. The pleasure to do that. And just such a pleasure to meet you too, Hope.
Yeah, pleasure to meet you.
Chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for sharing yourself with us, Taryn.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of Hope Unyielding. If you'd like to be entered in the drawing for 1 degree of freedom, please shoot me an email at hopeunyielding@gmail.com. by February 10th with 1 degree of freedom in the subject line. If this podcast has encouraged you, or you think it would encourage someone you know, please pass it along. Hope to see you guys next time.